Welcome to the 411 Child Podcast. Join us to get the 411 on child and adolescent development. Hosted by Beth, a longtime child and adolescent psychologist, and Jennifer, a master teacher. Today's topic is early memory and emotional development. Today's episode is sponsored by the Attention Center of Tampa Bay. Okay, so this is our first podcast, and I'm Beth.
And I'm Jennifer.
And what we're going to try to do is give you as many different tips and strategies as we can from the work that we've done with kids. And each week we'll give you some ideas about how to help your kids, you know, increase their memory or their attention or their learning or pretty much anything that any of you would like us to talk about. But I thought today maybe we would spend some time talking about how our memories, our childhood memories are formed and what we use them for. And it made me wonder, like, a lot of people can't remember their childhood memories. And I don't know, when was the last time, when's the first memory that you had?
Oh, wow. I was older. I think I blocked it all out somehow.
I think, yeah, like,
maybe
about
three?
How old?
Three, four, somewhere in there.
I can tell you mine. I was 3 years old, and we were living in Manhattan. And I had, remember those color forms?
Oh, gosh,
do you remember
yes.
the box of the color forms?
Oh, I
and
love
I
those.
Had, I guess, I was in my crib or something, and I got out the color forms,
yeah.
And of course I was being naughty. And my dad was in medical school at the time, and I think he had just come home. I don't know what time of night it was, but since I was just three. And, and I was playing with the color forms. I remember this very vividly. And he came in and he turned on the light. Now that tells you something. I was playing color forms
yeah,
in the dark.
Right.
Hello. It's no reason they thought I was. I was testing because they thought I was retarded. Perhaps that's why. So I.
She's retarded. She's playing color forms.
Yeah, in the dark, right? And so he throws on the light and you know hollers some horrible words. And next thing I know, I'm airborne and he's got me underneath one arm. He's got the color forms in another. We walk out into the hallway of our horrible, horrible, awful apartment complex. He opened the chute. They used to have trash chutes. They probably still do, but trash chutes.
Yeah, yeah.
Down with
oh,
the color forms.
No.
Slam the door shut. I remember, like, just, yeah.
Yeah, his first memory is of a tragic, like, punishment that he received
yeah.
as a child, spanking.
Yeah.
And that was his first memory. Yeah.
Yeah, isn't that nice? Hi, welcome
fabulous,
to the world. You don't remember anything, and then all of a sudden.
All your color forms are gone.
Yeah, exactly. All of a sudden, your color forms are totally gone to this day. Clearly, I'm still upset about that. But, and you say you were about three?
Yeah, but I don't remember. I couldn't tell you an exact memory. No.
But do you have, like, impressions?
Impressions of that time period. Yeah, toys I played with, you know, Christmases, birthdays, all in that time period.
Well, all the fun stuff.
The fun stuff.
Well, that's because you have nice parents.
Most of the time.
No, you do. You've got
yeah,
nice parents.
They're fabulous.
Mine were horrible.
Yeah.
So,
no, they're pretty fabulous.
Let me not say they're horrible. They were. Let's just say I have horrible memories.
Well, you know, it's funny. My mother had a similar memory, very young, of her paper dolls and her mother throwing her paper dolls away because
oh, no.
she didn't pick them up one time. And recently, I was going to do the same thing. Rose's room was a disaster. And I said, if you don't clean it up, I'm going to throw it all away. And I told my mother, I said that. She said, no, one of my biggest childhood memories is of my mom throwing away all of my paper dolls.
Whoa.
So she said, please don't do that to her so that she remembers that forever. And then so guilt.
But maybe if she remembers it forever, she'll never go back
again. So now the room is still a disaster, you know. But yeah, I got to thinking, wow, she still remembers that from being, like, young.
Yeah.
4, 5, 6 years old with her paper dolls.
And see, here's the thing that memory researchers say that, you know, these early childhood memories from infancy up until about 3 or 4 years old, we're just not capable of forming yet.
Yeah.
And we have all sorts of science that explain that because the prefrontal cortex, the front part of our brains, are not connected yet as infants.
Okay.
So we don't have a lot of, like, rhyme or reason yet
yeah.
in that area.
Yeah.
But our actual memories are formed in, like, where our emotion center is in the limbic system. It's sort of in the center of the brain. So it's not that infants don't have memories. It's that we are looking for memories that infants don't make.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And so by the time you're 3 or 4, you're learning how to talk, right?
Yeah.
And what age did your kids learn to walk?
Oh. Well, Rose was 8 months.
Wow.
Yeah, very early. Yeah, and talked early too. But she's nosy. So she wanted
she wanted
to get places that she couldn't get if she just sat on the middle of the floor. So.
And what about Aiden?
Yeah, Aiden was 9 months. And then so it was Claire.
And Claire was 2. Mm-hmm. And so really, and here's the funny thing about memory. Actually, the idea that you and I can walk, that your kids can walk and run, that's an infant memory.
Sure. Yeah.
So what happens is that it's not about our childhood memories that we can't remember. It's not like instances or episodes. It's more about the idea that I can walk, I can talk,
right.
I'm potty trained.
Mm-hmm.
Those things happen. And
yes.
Those are the memories.
Yes.
And so we end up building on that. So our infant memories are, you know, not so much of like, well, having your color forms thrown away. Those, but it's more of this idea of, you know, I can learn how to talk and people show me words.
Yes.
And so forth. Mm-hmm. And so I build my memories that way.
It amazes me, you know, when they're born, they know absolutely nothing. I mean, they know nothing. I mean, even with nursing, they don't even know how to do. You think they would be born knowing how to eat, but they don't. You have to teach them everything. And then by the time they're one, they're talking and walking and stacking blocks.
Yeah.
And, you know, things, it's just amazing.
I know. And it's interesting because, like you said, it's not like they know how to eat, but they do know how to eat. It's weird. It's like,
mm-hmm.
You're right, you do have to teach them, but it's not like you can use words to teach them.
No.
You simply move them to the breast or
yeah.
the nipple.
And three or four times, they get that.
That's right. And they have a reflexive sucking action, as
yeah.
you know. And because...
Yes.
Is there something outside the window?
No, I just have, like, this really bad memory.
and you know, it's this whole idea that, like, babies are born with this incredible ability to learn and yet not remember much.
Yes. Yes.
But let's be honest. What kind of memory would you want to have from your infancy?
Absolutely none.
Exactly.
What a tragic period of time.
Yeah, that's a good point,
they,
really.
They don't remember what I looked like when they were infants, because, you know, the hair was... the black circles.
Oh, it's the only doll I had, and I pull her hair so that... Oh, she was really sad looking.
That's okay. One of the strawberry shortcakes got a haircut at my house this morning. Some yellow hair.
They cut the Barbie hair yet?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Yes. Barbie hair doesn't grow back.
No. No.
Did they
you
just
know
cut
that Rose cut her hair when she was 2, right after Aiden was born? To the scalp, right there.
No.
She had this little V-shape right there. Yeah. Yeah.
And,
experimenting with Susan.
And that's how we know she's advanced.
So special.
But, and as you had said earlier, though, that for John and for me, and I'm glad you don't have any tragic memories of your early childhood.
I don't. None of my early childhood, now.
Again, your mother's nice, so.
I mean, I guess some of my first ones are of her leaving me, because she started working when I was 3. So up until then, my life was very idyllic. And I have memories of, because she was a court, she did the transcriptionist for a court reporter, and she'd do that at home, and we'd watch Search for Tomorrow every day. But yeah, my first tragic memory, I mean, my first real memories are kind of tragic, of her leaving me in a preschool that I didn't like, you know. And the one day that I forgot my stuffed animal at home and cried for 8 hours, you know, yeah.
Isn't that amazing how something like that we do remember?
We do. It's connected to emotions. It seems to stick with you forever.
That's right. And
yeah.
And like you said earlier too, with John and my memories of now, that one is that, like, it's that powerful emotion
yeah.
of fear.
Yes.
And you know, and it looks like sadness, right? Because of the crying and so forth, but it's not.
I was afraid. Yeah, I was all alone. Yeah.
That's really scary.
All alone. Yeah. Which is why I think when I dropped Rose off at 10 weeks, the babysitters, for the first time, I never got over it. And I think it went directly back to that.
Oh, definitely.
It was horrible. I counted down the days that I, you know, when I got pregnant with Aiden, okay, I only have 35 more days to drop her off. 22 more days. Yeah.
See, that's really hard.
It was tragic.
I told you, my sister and brother-in-law, my niece, my first niece was born,
yeah.
and, you know, Sarah and Tip took her to daycare, and that day, my brother-in-law skipped his job, didn't tell my sister, and spent the entire day at the daycare because he was afraid to leave his daughter.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was that, then Sarah came, he left right before Sarah came to pick up, you know, his daughter,
yeah.
And
yeah.
she went in, and they said, your husband is just wonderful. I was just like, how do you know my husband? Well, he stayed all day.
Well, then we moved her to Awela's house.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Right.
And she was fabulous. And see, she knew Spanish back then.
Right.
She knew every word she said to her. Doesn't remember any of it now.
Well.
Because she was two when she left there.
And when did she start going there? How old was she?
She would have been like 8 months. Yeah, 8 months.
And was she like babbling at that time? She was past babbling.
Yes, she was talking. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And see, what's neat about that is, go back to the infant brain, is that we're born with the ability to speak any language,
mm-hmm.
any language at all.
Yeah.
And we only know what language to speak, from, of course, from what we hear.
Yes. Yeah.
And what a lot of people don't know, and what's backwards in our country as far as like foreign languages, is that our learning the language starts when we're very, very little, by hearing all the
mm-hmm.
sounds around us.
Yes.
All of the neural passages then become very, very strong for those sounds.
Yeah.
Once we get to be about 9 or 10 years old, there's this process called pruning. Just like when you go outside with, you remember this from your school probably. But and in pruning, what happens is that all these sounds that we've never made and we really haven't heard, like Aboriginal sounds.
Oh,
or,
right.
Or my husband cannot make the sound.
Oh, really?
He can't.
What's ours?
No, at all. And which is really kind of sad. It's speaking of. So he can't even roll his R's.
Wow.
And that's because his brain pruned away that ability.
Hmm.
Now, my parents, again, thinking I was retarded, put me in an after-school program. I think I was 7 years old to learn Spanish, because clearly I guess English wasn't going to work.
Telephones aren't working for us.
So, you know, it was one of these experimental programs in the 70s, and let's get our daughter in there. Because, you know, we speak French and English, so we'll have her speak Spanish. I don't know.
We're also
right, so I was in this program. So from the time I was 7, 8, 9, 10, I think for 4 years,
okay.
After school, I was made to go to this program. But as a result, my brain held on to all of the Spanish sounds.
Oh,
and
sure.
So nice to say somewhere. And I'd say, as long as you say I'm bring in all of this information at that time, and then I got rid of all the other sounds that I can't
that makes
make.
Sense. Yeah, that makes sense.
And I know I made fun of my husband. I should probably make fun of myself now. I think I've told you. I'm trying to learn Japanese.
Yes.
Can I say about this?
Yeah.
It's apparently very funny, because I think I speak Japanese with a Spanish accent, so.
Yeah, John knows the numbers, like, up to 10, and he's always singing this little song. All right, then go to Japan and just count for people, you know?
Well, now, see, you're laughing, but the program I'm going through, apparently I can say things like, there are the little boy and girl drinking water.
Oh.
There's a newspaper.
Oh.
Yeah.
First thing I learned in language is, where's the bathroom?
Well, yeah,
that's
not in the program. and I'm learning how to read Japanese, all the figures. But again, nothing related to basic needs, so.
Yeah, see, that's a problem.
It is a problem.
Yeah.
But anyway, this all goes back to this idea that we have, our brains have this ability to prune away all of this language that we just would never use, ever. And,
that's what I'm afraid she's done. I mean, my gosh, they're receptive. Her receptive vocabulary was unbelievable. She understood everything that was said to her. Because Abuela's mom was in her 90s at the time and only spoke Spanish. And she understood everything she was saying. And it makes me sad. I should have kept up with that.
Well,
to some degree. I mean,
You studied Spanish.
Oh, I did, yeah.
And you know, you're fluent in everything, so.
Oh. Yeah, that was senior French class. So.
It's like, we just found the other day an old Spanish textbook my sister and my brother-in-law found.
Yeah.
It was the old Churros y Chocolate. And we were all dying because every one of us had the same book. And you know, it's 15 pages of Where's the Bathroom and I Like Chocolate.
Oh, well, those are two very
compatible ideas.
Can I have some chocolate at first? That's why at least I could go to Spain or Mexico and find that one. That's about it.
And apparently order some chocolate, but outside of that.
Yeah, I can count. I know the colors.
Well, that's
But I don't say them well. Like, when I used to talk to Xenia and Maria,
and
they were talking in Spanish, I'd catch about every third or fourth word, I'd say. Yeah. And then they'd translate for me. I guess they felt bad for me.
But you know, what's funny is that you're able to do that,
mm-hmm.
and you don't use Spanish.
No, I don't.
So,
But you know what? The French never came to me. I took that 1 year of French.
Yeah.
And they do, their pronunciation of sounds is just entirely different than our pronunciation of sounds.
Well, you were in high school, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It did not come to me. And that makes sense with pruning. I had already gotten rid of I don't know how they pronounce words. It was very confusing. I could not make the very nasal sounds that they make.
Yeah. And that's basically because your brain is saying, you know, I'm sorry, we no longer have that sound production.
Yeah. But growing up in South Florida, I grew up around, you know, we always had Spanish speaking people around.
Right.
So you heard the language, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. And the other thing too is that you have a very musical ear. And
yeah, that helps too.
And a lot of people, mm-hmm. yes, and it helps early in life for picking up all of those sounds.
Yeah.
But again, because of neural pruning, even once mm-hmm. you go forward.
That makes sense.
Yeah, you still
that's
can't.
That's why I can sing Latin.
Right.
Right.
Exactly.
Because I've been singing that since I was a child.
And, you know, and the thing about the memories is that it all goes to this part of the brain that is so incredibly important to us that we don't really use so much when we're infants. And everything's just sort of imprinted on us. But if you were to see, if we could just stick an infant underneath an MRI and leave the child there for a couple years and still expose the child to everything, you would see the most amazing, like, lit up pictures of the brain.
Oh, sure.
In a way that our adult brains just don't. They just don't. And, you know, so when I talk to parents who we work with, I don't, of course, go this long into it, but, you know, I explain to them that if they want to help their kids to learn language or if they want to help them increase their memory, that one of the things they can do is to realize that any learning-type memory, if they can create some kind of emotion around it, not that we want them to hate math or hate science or hate reading.
But that's where the fun emotion comes in, the happy emotions.
Yeah.
The excited emotions, yeah.
Yeah, and the only way we can do that, of course, is to find something that they're interested in.
Yeah.
And that's the real challenge, isn't it?
It is. It is. Especially with little ones. Sometimes they don't know what they're interested in yet. They're all over the place. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a whole movement in like homeschooling called mm-hmm. unschooling. And it's not actually what you think it is. It's not... not schooling at all. It's they wait until the child's interested in something.
Right.
And that's what they learn about. So they may learn about boats for 6 months, but they'll know everything about boats and have read books about boats and math problems with boats and you know, they might learn about how long it takes a boat to get from one place to another or whatever. But yeah, it's all about boats. And then they'll go on to something else.
That sounds and then so everything's thematic, right?
Everything.
And then, there's a whole town in Italy called Emilia Reggio, Reggio Emilia, I'm going to have to look it up, but the entire town came together for a couple of their schools, and what they decided to do was exactly what you said. Now, this model has been in place for 20, 30, 40 years, and it's exactly that. We're tradespeople from the town.
Wow.
All the kids go to, like, everybody's kid goes to these schools,
okay.
And then the tradespeople come in, and offer their services. So it might be, for example, very similar, like they've got 5-year-olds who are learning to build, let's say, a canoe.
Yeah.
And so they'll have 3 of the parents come in, you know, somebody will be a boat builder, somebody will be a carpenter, somebody will be, some sort of craftsman on painting or something.
Yeah.
And the kids will be in there using sharp, you know, saws. They have to figure out problems like measurements, and
That's
they have to figure out balance type things and but they're guided not just by their teacher but by the parents who come in and you know offer their expertise.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it sounds a lot like
it is
that.
Similar. Yeah, I've known families, and they're usually very large families, but they'll go down to the beach, and it's not just they're going to the beach, but they're dissecting the sand, and they have, you know, they bring shells home, and they identify the shells. I mean, it's a whole process around just a day at the beach. Yeah,
and that's why I was so impressed when we were, where were we with your kids? Oh, we went to lunch or something, but I can't remember, but we were somewhere, and you turned an entire, like, shopping trip into a lesson.
Yes.
And you know, we go to eat, and you turn, you show them the menu, and you have them decide, and then we talk about what's on the menu and so forth, and, I mean, you turn everything into a lesson with your kids.
Sure, like a trip to the grocery store, you know, if a bag of potato chips... 2 for $5. Well, what if I only want 1?
Right.
And, you know, they don't know that that's division. They don't know what they're doing, but they can figure it out, you know. And
right.
That's real-world application, and, yeah, that's going to stick in their memory forever.
Right. And the neat thing is that you're actually allowing them to learn vicariously through
yes.
all of these experiences.
Yes.
And that's really what I mean when I say to attach emotion to
mm-hmm.
learning. It doesn't
mm-hmm.
have to be that, you know, they're happy about this or happy about
no.
that. It's more the getting rid of the fear. And,
yes.
you know, because, you've got glad, sad, mad, and scared as the four basic emotions. They all occupy our attention and our memory. And so, you know, if you've got a child who is scared to death of getting in trouble for being wrong,
yeah,
it doesn't matter what you...
That's so interesting that there's three, I don't want to call them negative emotions.
They are
but
negative.
There are negative three and only one happy one. One
yeah.
positive one.
Well, that's actually sort of a, there's a question in there,
wow.
right? And so...
That makes me want to cry. Oh, no.
Well, I think...
Well, no wonder that I'm only glad a quarter of the time.
Well, I don't think so much that it's like negative versus positive, although it feels that
it
certainly
feels that way, sure.
Yeah, and
yeah.
socially speaking, we have definitely made it that way.
Yes.
But what a lot of people don't know is that human beings all have a set contentment point.
Ah.
So each one of us has our own little what you need to be content. Now,
okay.
think back to your three children when they were infants.
Yeah.
Okay. Who was your most sensitive?
Oh, Aiden still is.
Yeah, and
yes.
he still is, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't take much to set him off. And
no. mm-hmm.
and so he has, his is sort of very fragile right now. His contentment
very,
point.
Very, yes.
Yeah.
Very sensitive little boy.
Yeah, he is.
Yeah.
And who's your most even child?
Oh, Claire.
By far.
Oh, yeah.
By far. So you
very
have this
easy.
Going. And she, you know,
mm-hmm.
except when either she wants some attention or...
Yes.
Or there is something that is stirred up, like,
yeah.
you know, when she comes to my house and
yes.
you know, we've got the cats, the tat.
Going.
Very easy.
Yes.
And, you know.
Yes.
But she also is so smart that she can work her way out of that pretty
oftentimes,
fast.
Oftentimes, yes.
Yeah.
And some of that is learned because
right.
Rose is so overly
yeah.
that a lot of what she's learned how to deal with situations, she's learned from Rose.
Right.
So when she screams like that, that's because Rose will scream so that she takes it to a completely different level.
Yes. That's
really dramatic.
Yes, right. Very nice way of making mm-hmm. the difference between screaming and shrieking.
Okay. It is really shrieking, though.
Yeah. It is. It's, yes.
It is.
It is.
Yeah. But, I mean, Aiden is still so sensitive that he likes to be in the same room with me all the time.
Yeah.
You know, and if he's not, it bothers him.
Yeah. And so you are still sort of a real important part of his
yes.
contentment.
Like, I wonder what would happen if I sent him to school in August, because he should start kindergarten in August.
Yeah.
And I really wonder how he would deal with that. Because all of his memories are me in the room. And I know that's bad. I've tried to start enrolling him in things, you know, to get him so that there is a little
yeah.
bit of a disconnect between mommy. But I wonder, because I am his, I'm his, like, fortress. And
oh, I know you are.
He hangs on to me. Like,
yeah, and he comes and cuddles with you a lot.
Yeah.
But that's okay. I mean, it's fine now. If he
yes.
was 15 in that way, yes,
that
I
would
have...
be disturbing.
we would have a heart-to-heart.
Yeah.
But I, it's interesting that you said that, you know, your youngest looks at your oldest
yes.
as far as mimicking behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
And again, goes back to the brain.
Mm-hmm.
We have these things called mirror neurons. Mirror
okay.
neurons.
Okay.
And it's just like what it sounds like. Monkey see, monkey do.
Yeah.
And
that makes sense.
Yeah, and it helps
yes.
us encode from the time we're infants,
right.
as a matter of fact,
mm-hmm.
how to be human.
Yes.
And
yeah.
and in a lot of cases, it'll be how to be human according to the right gender. So
okay.
that's why, you know, we talk about in our society how, you know, little boys need a father.
Yeah.
But we don't really know why. I mean, it seems like it makes sense that
it
we
does.
Need to have a man and a woman in a family or a
right.
man and a man, whatever. But they
right.
need different, they need different influences from different genders. The reason is because our brain is wired to pick up those messages. And
mm-hmm.
if you're a little boy and you have a male somewhere who's close to you,
yeah.
then that's who you're going to learn to act like to be a boy.
Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah, and
yeah.
and that's why a lot of times sports is passed down, sort of.
Right.
So if a dad's really into sports, you know,
mm-hmm.
he'll somehow, the little boy will either really be into sports or maybe if he's not athletic, he will be as far as keeping track of stats and so
right.
forth.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of men are socialized with sports.
That's
and
true.
A lot of guys who aren't feel
yeah.
a little bit left
yeah.
out.
Right. Yeah, and see, I used to hang out with my dad. I was his son.
Yeah.
yeah. And so, I mean, the sports thing is big with me. And then John didn't. So in our house, I'm the one that has the picture-in-picture going with the, you know, the football game and the NASCAR down here. And
Atlanta
yeah.
Braves.
They're so disappointing recently. Okay.
Yes, but I have to tell you, we went to see the Rays play the other night.
Oh, did you?
We did.
Yeah.
But I digress.
Well, not really. No. Which depends on who they were playing.
The Cleveland Indians.
They've been hot
they
and
won.
Cold recently.
Yeah, so. They won.
Yeah. See how that I just kind of go, woo.
I know. Right? That's okay.
NASCAR's on, don't buy. I have actually said that to my children. Okay. But it's funny because that's how I related to my dad as a child.
Yeah.
My sister, you know, I had parents, sorry. You know, my mom and I have always been very close.
Yes.
And my dad and my sister were very close.
Yes.
And that was the way I related to my dad, even as a small child. You know, I wrote this great short story in college about this poor girl who was taken, she was 7, 8, 9, taken to the baseball game with her dad, which was totally true. He would get off work early because Kansas City spring training was a block from our house.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
So we would walk, crawl under the fence. We thought we were getting away with something. All we were doing was just cutting our trip short. You know, and we'd come in. He still paid for tickets. Yeah, you go in. But I wrote this great story about it, and I let my mom read it. Screaming at my dad. She was screaming, I can't believe you did this to I know, it was a story. It's fiction. Because the only way the girl relates to her dad is through sports. And he ignores her other than that. And I'm like, no, that's not, it was a fictional story, Mom. But to some extent, him and I always went to the baseball games. Still do.
That explains it.
Still do.
Yeah.
Like, the sweetest moment ever was at a Rays game. With Aiden sitting on his lap.
Oh, how sweet.
It made us all cry because he'd finally gotten his boy.
Right.
You know, the only boy.
That's right. Boy, that's
right. And sitting here watching a baseball game. We were all like in tears. Everyone was looking at us like we were nuts, but we were all crying. It's like, that's so sweet. He finally got his boy. You know?
That is sweet.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, will Aiden be in baseball? I don't know. That's still up in the air. So.
I might toughen him up a little bit.
Well, my dad was, he was actually, the Cincinnati Reds actually wanted him. At one time for pitching.
Oh my gosh.
So I mean, he actually was really good in his day. Yeah.
I believe it.
In his day. No, he's just slow and doddering. But
oh, I love your dad. I love your dad. But you know, that's interesting because now you're talking about opposite, like, you know, female male relationships.
Yeah.
And there's, again, those mirror neurons will pick up relationships. You'll watch your mom and your dad's behaviors. And we often tell you, I've heard over and over again, oh, girls always look for their fathers to marry. And it's sort of like, really? No. I used to say that all the time. No. I look at my own husband now and I think,
yeah, I married my dad. I say that all the time.
And yet, the interesting thing is that when you go all the way back and you think about your schooling, what are some of your earliest memories of school activities or of lessons or...
See, isn't that funny? I don't have a lot because, and I don't want to like slam Catholic schools, but the Catholic schools are so much about textbooks.
Right.
Well, they still are.
Right.
I mean, you know, when I was teaching, I had to fight to not use a textbook.
Right.
And... Yeah, so it was all linked to textbook learning. So the few things I remember are like just like really great teachers who all of a sudden had this moment of some kind, you know, Bible history class where, you know, she just had this moment, Sister Sally did, and, you know, Mrs. Placheco running around the room because we all spelled receive wrong in our confirmation essays.
Oops!
So she ran around the room, and that's still how I spell it. I can picture her in my head going, R-C, you know. And it just, stuff like that sticks with me because we were just textbook based entirely.
And I had a very opposite experience than you. Yeah, because when I first started school, I was in public school.
Okay.
And we were up in upstate New York because my father was, I think he was doing his internship and residency. And so during that time, and this is early 1970s, I went to a school there for kindergarten and first grade.
Okay.
My dad then went into Vietnam and or was drafted, and we went down to Potomac, Maryland, where I went to school second and third grade to a school.
Okay.
We moved again, and I went fourth and fifth grade to a school, and then sixth grade in another school. And I finally got into Catholic schools right around that time. But prior to that, I was in a public school in sort of the early 70s when they had the open school.
Yeah.
The idea was, of course, an entire school floor with no walls at all.
I interned in a school like that.
It's the worst idea ever.
Freaky.
It is. And we had, you know, sort of pods. And so
yes.
Yeah, it seemed all very outer space to me. I don't know. I was fourth grade. They put me in a 4th, 5th, and 6th grade class.
Okay.
Me and Heather Murphy, I'll never forget. And the two of us sat under one of those carrels, with the SRA kit. And we read the entire SRA kit from beginning to end, and that was 4th grade. I don't think our 4th grade teacher even knew that we were assigned to her. So,
oh my gosh.
I don't remember. Yeah, and I remember like being really interested in 6th grade math, so I would sneak into the 6th grade math like classes, and and I just had fun. I just, because you know, I was little, I was cute, and I was sort of smart, so I just went wherever I wanted and learned whatever I wanted. Or not, and my parents were horrified. Oh my goodness, horrified. And my mother wrote all of those horrible letters that nobody ever wants.
Oh,
you know? And,
yeah, I hear you.
Yeah, and so I learned really nothing. Just nothing.
Sad.
Nothing. And yet I remember being angry that I didn't learn a whole lot. And it was right around that time, I think I was 8 and a half, when I decided that I was going to have to take over my own learning.
Okay.
And sort of forget everyone else. I'll just take over my own learning, and that's it. And so I had more of those types of memories. And I actually craved, once I got into Catholic school, I was happy because that whole textbook thing and all that, that appealed to me because I could. Yeah. But yeah, so she, you know, my brain was able to bring in all of this information at that time, and then I got rid of all the other sounds that I can't
make.
That makes
sense. Yeah, that makes sense. Memories. No. Because I was reading when I went into 1st grade.
Right.
But my 1st grade teacher didn't really foster that. So when I went into 2nd grade, it just so happened that my 2nd grade teacher, see, this is small town, you know, my 2nd grade teacher was married to my godfather.
Oh, right.
So she's like, I knew Jennifer could read. I know she can read. I heard her read when she was in kindergarten. I know what's going on. Well, so they decided that they were going to try and, you know, I don't know, give me something to work towards. So I read at our first communion. First child in the parish's history to ever read from the altar. So that's what I worked for all year, me and Eddie. Oh, he was so cute. All year, that's what we worked towards. And I got up on Mother's Day weekend at First Communion. Can you imagine?
Oh, my goodness.
Thousands of people
in that church. Yeah.
And I got up there, but I knew that reading by heart. I got up there and I read the whole thing, and the whole church was, you know, mouths agape.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness, this child did it. And it was all on my shoulders.
Right.
Father Anglim said, it's all on you.
Right.
You know, if she reads well, then we'll continue doing this. It was like, oh, please. You know, no pressure. But I have memories like that. I can't remember day to day, because it was get out your textbook, open it to page 60.
But even though I wasn't in that, you know, that environment
in 2nd grade
until later, I have no memories of being in these open classrooms where everything was very creative. In fact,
and I probably would have been fabulous in the open. I hated teaching in the pod classroom.
Yeah.
But I think I would have liked learning in the pod classroom.
You probably would have. And it wasn't that I didn't. It was just that I learned the wrong stuff. I learned more social type things, like watching people and so forth. And
John tells a funny story of getting his workbook. I can't remember. I want to say 2nd grade.
Uh-huh.
Getting the reading workbook on day one of school. And, you know, they pass them out and write your name in the brand new workbook. And he said by the end of the day, he'd finished it.
I'm sure he had,
asked back to the teacher, and she was really angry, because this is your workbook for the whole year. And you finished the whole thing. Yeah, he's still like that, but, you know.
And I know, but see what happened with his attitude about learning. And he still has a great attitude about learning, but self-guided.
On his own terms.
Right. You know? And so this goes back to this idea that, you know, if children are given, if they make any association with being afraid or being angry, then it's very difficult to teach whatever concept that the child is stuck with.
Well, we were talking a little earlier about my math learning disability.
Yeah.
I can tell you the day it started.
Really?
I can tell you that it's definitely tied to some kind of emotion that I have in 3rd grade.
Yeah.
Back then they thought if you read well, you did math well. You had to, if you read really well.
Right.
So this was 3rd grade.
Right.
I had that epiphany in 2nd grade. I read to thousands of people, and I was reading like a fiend in 3rd grade.
Right.
Just, you know, everything I could. So they put me in the high math group and the high reading group. Well, math, I was clueless. We were starting division and those long subtraction problems with, you know, 6 and 7 steps. And
right.
I had no clue what I was doing. And so I did.
Right. You know? And so this goes back to this idea that, you know, if children are given, if they make any association with being afraid or being angry, yes. Mm-hmm. Then it's very difficult to teach whatever concept that the child is stuck with.
Well, we were talking a little earlier about my math learning disability.
Yeah.
I can tell you the day it started.
Really?
I can tell you that it's definitely tied to some kind of emotion that I have in third grade.
Yeah.
Back then they thought if you read well, you did math well. You had to, if you read really
right.
well. So this was third grade.
Right.
I had that epiphany in second grade. I read to thousands of people, and I was reading like a fiend in third grade. It was
right.
just, you know, everything I kept. So they put me in the high math group and the high reading group. Well, math, I was clueless. We were starting division. And those long subtraction problems with,
right.
you know, 6 and 7 steps. And
right.
I had no clue what I was doing. And so I got yanked out of the high math group one day in math class with all 35 kids in the room.
Oh, no.
And was told to go back to my seat. I was, like, you know, crying. And I shut down. I just shut down. And so I can tell you the exact day. My attitude toward math changed.
And see, that's more of a math trauma.
It is a trauma.
Yeah. And mm-hmm. the interesting thing is that then can really damage your attitude
it
towards
did.
Learning a particular subject for the rest of your life, pretty
yeah.
much.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the types of things that you and I work with kids to try to conquer, because
yes.
it's so hard to get. It's interesting.
Uh-huh.
Even though a child can get the concept, even though the child will understand the concept, still tell you it can't do it.
Yes.
I can't do math. Well, but you just showed me that you can.
Yes.
No, I did that problem. But I can't
do math.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
And it's just that we've taught. It's astounding to me how deep those memories
they
are.
Do.
And they just seem to really stay out of, they keep us from being able to not only create good memories, but to remember the actual content.
Right.
And the actual lessons.
Exactly.
And you know, so I guess this all rolls back into, well, how do you get a child to remember information that you're teaching in school, or you know, or that you're teaching them at home? And the real answer there is that if there's some way, it's not to help them feel good about learning,
mm-hmm.
it's to protect them from hating learning.
That
and
makes
from
absolute sense.
Being afraid of learning, and to separate emotion from it as much as possible.
Yes.
Because what happens is that now, you know, as a child psychologist, I see these teenagers who come in and they have incredible problems with emotions. They've got emotional problems where they've shut down their anger, they've shut down their fear, they don't want to talk to anybody, and yet they have incredible problems with emotions. They've got emotional problems where they've shut down their anger, they've shut down their fear, they don't want to talk to anybody, and they're trying to hold back that keeps them from being able to actually learn any information.
Absolutely. I mean, I look at my husband, and gosh, I don't want to give too much away, but he connects, especially his college education with
yes.
such negative emotions. I think
yeah.
it was, because I mean, I knew him when he was getting his AA back
right.
when he was 18 and 19, and he had very negative experiences at that time in his life.
Right.
And he's gone back to school 3 or 4 times.
Right.
And we're still working on our AA degree.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And I can't get him to like break past the point that he can do it.
Right.
He lacks the motivation to do it, but I think it's more than that.
It is.
I don't believe he thinks he can do it.
And that's,
and the man is so smart.
Oh, he's brilliant. And that's an astounding, I mean, on your part, that's very insightful, because that's exactly right. The development of the attitude of not being motivated or being
mm-hmm.
unmotivated comes from a fear.
Yeah.
And the fear of failure then becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yes.
Where he just is
yeah.
that won't go far enough to succeed, because that's actually scary.
I think it's going to take me, and I hate to be like this, but I think it's going to take me signing him up,
yeah,
paying for the class, buying
yeah.
the book, and saying,
yeah.
here,
yeah,
go.
Yeah.
I think that's what it's going to take. And
yeah.
I want him to do it, because I know he'll get more out of it if he
right.
does it himself, but I don't think he will.
But isn't that really what we do with kids, too?
It is.
Yeah. And
mm-hmm.
and it. I mean, you taught third grade. How did you deal with that with your kids? Well, unmotivated learner.
Oh boy, yeah, because I had quite a few over the years. I mean, kids who didn't want to, kids right. who could but wouldn't. I mean, you had all those at that age are starting to really come into their own.
Yes.
And they know that that's a funny age because in second grade, they're really afraid of their teacher.
Right, I know.
So they want to do everything to make her happy.
Right.
In fourth grade, they'll tell you to go.
Right, yes.
Take a flying leap. So yeah. This is in between.
Yeah.
And they're almost ready to tell you to take a flying leap, but they still want to please you.
Right.
So oftentimes you can get them to do things because they want to please you. And they want to do the right thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And developmentally that falls right within their moral development.
Yes.
But what is so hard is that once they get past that age, and like you say, when they will tell you that they're not what you have to say, and that of course is very different than when we were kids, because we didn't really have that right.
No, we didn't have, that wasn't an option.
It was not an option.
You told your teacher that, and your teacher told your parents that you had done that, then ow.
You're no longer interested. You're in trouble twice.
That was mostly a painful thing.
Very painful. You were in trouble in both places, both school and at home. And, you know, and so we were raised sort of in fear. Now, that's not a good thing either, but, you know, it's... Now, with kids now, it's, you know, you get to a 9 or a 10 or 11-year-old, and I can't tell you how many 13 or 14-year-old boys have been dragged in, and, you know, parents have said to me, he doesn't want to see you, but you have to figure out a way to fix him, and I know that.
It's nice to meet you,
John. You know, I went through just 2 weeks ago, I went through one with a 13-year-old boy who's been here 3 times, and quite frankly, I told the mom, finally, you're right, he's right. He refuses to work with me.
Wow.
I don't want to charge you any money. Yeah. But we decided we would try something a little gentler and something where he's interested, where I'm now sending books home with mom.
Okay.
And he's reading the books. And then when he's done, he comes in and talks to me about the books. And we play a game. Why do you think I sent that home? What do you see in there? I'm trying to not ignite any of his emotions, basically.
Right.
Particularly
Absolutely.
That of, you know, hating me.
Yeah, hate you. Yeah, that's a dangerous age, too, because, boy, once they do, it's hard to break through that.
It is.
That age, it just sticks with them forever.
Yeah.
That anger and hatred and fear and,
And I think, so if you were giving advice to parents whose kids are really having a difficult time remembering things, pretty much because they have some sort of an attitude about their learning or about the subject, what kind of things do you think might help them?
Well, I find, you know, simply because I homeschool, and that's where kind of some of this is coming from, is they've all had some sort of block in some area. Rose's was math, and I discovered that she was frustrated because she was having trouble with just one portion of math, and I found that she loves time and money. Who knew?
Right.
That child can tell time better than most of the third graders I had.
Right.
She just ended first grade.
Right.
Because I found that that's what she liked. And she can count money and change. It's hysterical. She's like a little banker. Little green visor on and she counts it like crazy. But we stopped for a few weeks doing the other thing. And we did something that she did enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
So then I connected that. Okay, well, if you're counting money, then you have to add and subtract.
Right.
Oh, well, you're right. I have to learn how to add and subtract so I can add and subtract the money that I enjoy counting. So we just connected that fun aspect of something that she was good at and motivated to do with something that she wasn't motivated to do. And I used to try to do that with my third graders, too. They did not like learning multiplication tables.
Hated it. I used to see your kids out there one at a time rotated with your aid.
And frankly, I hated teaching it because they hated it so much. It was this vibe in the room.
Yeah.
Well, then we had contests. Then it was all about contests because they were happy if they... So they wanted those stickers on the chart, and they wanted to go out into the hallway, and they wanted to challenge each other, and they thought it was amazing when I did them, how fast I could do them.
Right.
And they were like, wow, I want to be as fast as her. So, you know, it was, then we just changed it into a completely different atmosphere, and they started enjoying it more.
And that's really what it is. I mean, it's like what I do when I'm working with kids in therapy, it's the same thing that you do as a teacher, and same thing I did as a school counselor, which is... You find what they're good at, you find their interests, and you use a backdoor approach.
Yes.
And that backdoor approach is to simply, like you said, connect the skill or the interest that they have to something that, to that horrible, awful thing.
Yes.
And, you brought up another key point, which is that because their prefrontal cortex are not fully developed yet, they will do exactly as you said, which is generalize, not liking one small part of math, one concept, one thing that's hard, and generalizing that to all of math.
Right.
When in fact, that's really not true for almost any of them.
Yes.
You know?
And you can do that with, I mean, any subject, really. And sometimes it's just a point of breaking it down with them, too. Let's say they're not understanding parts of speech.
Right.
And they look at that sentence, and it just seems overwhelming.
Right.
I don't know what these 10 words can possibly mean.
Right.
But maybe it's just starting at the very beginning again. Saying, okay, you know what a noun is. Let's find all the nouns.
Right.
What kind of nouns are they? Could you change that noun to a different noun? Let's change the whole meaning of the sentence. Now you've got a silly sentence because you changed the man to a dog or something. And now, you know, like that's why, what were those? Mad Libs.
Mad Libs, yeah.
Amazing, because they don't know that they're doing something to learn.
Right.
But they are. And there's these funny stories at the end. And, oh, parts of speech are funny. So now, yeah, okay, that's not so bad. Let's figure out what these parts of speech are. And we go from there. You know, and then some kids like to draw, so now you're diagramming sentences because they really like, well, and especially your more analytical kids.
Exactly, that's what I was going
to
say.
Love, oh, I used to love, and I'm not going to, maybe they're just not going to do it.
No,
because
right?
they connected,
that's right.
They don't like this
right.
part, so I'm not going to like any of it.
That's right, and and they'll say, I can't do it.
Yes.
And I can't do it should be translated. All parents who are listening, I can't do it means I don't like it. It means I refuse to do it.
Yes.
It's just, it's not that they can't do it. It's that they just...
Another level. Sometimes just sitting there with their...
Just have given up completely. And...
Yeah. Rose, by age 3, could write the entire alphabet.
Mm-hmm.
And would. I'd sit her down with one of those little mats that you wipe off.
Yeah.
And she'd sit there and she'd make all of her letters. Aiden at 3, he would make an A. I don't want to do this. I can't do this anymore. I just can't. Oh, please. You wrote, you know... And I was very frustrated with him. And honestly, I would... You have to do this. You're getting behind. You must do this.
Yeah.
And I checked myself just one day.
Yeah.
And I said, why am I doing this? So I give him 3 letters a day. And you know what? He is right where she was.
See?
It's just that he did it in his own way.
Right.
He's not her.
Right.
They're different people. And he's fine. His handwriting is actually better than hers.
Wow.
And he just did it 3 letters a day. Instead of her 26. You know, and that's fine. It was his way. So we also can't lump the kids all into one category either.
No.
We have to think they're all different and they're all going to learn differently and be motivated by different things.
And actually, our next podcast will be exactly about that. We're going to talk about the myth of learning styles.
Ah.
And so I think we'll leave it there. So thank you for joining us today. Thanks so much for joining us for the 411 Child Podcast. The podcast for adults who want to better understand their children, teenagers, and themselves. Until next time, be well.